Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. The 2008 Summer Olympic Games in Beijing set many athletic and historic precedents, not the least of which was the American dominance in swimming, led by the extraordinary Michael Phelps with 8 gold medals. However, the Games were not without controversy in and out of competition, and with us this morning to recap the Games of the 29th Olympiad is Dr. Andrew Owusu, Assistant Professor of Health and Human Performance and a 3-time Olympian himself. Andrew's specialty was the triple jump. He is a 4-time African champion and an 8-time All-American. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Anna.
Andrew, let's start with track and field since that was your forte. The U.S. track and fields team was initially characterized by commentators as abysmal after some very high-profile failures, including the dropping of the batons by the men's and women's 4x100-meter relay teams, but they got 23 medals overall and 7 gold, which was still the most of any country. So was the overall performance as dismal as has been opined by some people?
I don't think I'll characterize it as dismal, because if you take into account the dropping of the baton both by the men and the women in the 4x100-meter relay, that has nothing to do with performance per se. They just messed up and dropped the baton. So in terms of the quality of the athletes who were representing the U.S., it was as high as it's probably, or one of the highest quality field representing the U.S. However, in some of the traditional in some of the events where the U.S. Has had quite a strong representation, such as the long jump, triple jump, this time around, the U.S. really didn't have athletes in those events who actually made it into the final. So, with that regard, some of the traditional events in which the U.S. has traditionally been strong was not as great.
We did not get a medal in the javelin or the pole vault, I think. We did get a medal in the shot put, but 2 out of the 3 athletes I saw fouled consistently. Mm-hmm. The commentators on the networks of NBC called the U.S. track and field team's overall performance a failure of leadership, and they seem to be implying that heads should roll at the top levels. Do you think that that's fair?
Whenever a team or an organization doesn't live up to its potential, somebody has to take the blame for it. And so it's not unusual to hear people saying that heads have to roll at the top. In fact, in Ghana, where I come from, is the same thing we are facing with regards to heads have to roll. But having said that, there's only so much coaches or the technical staff can do, because once the athletes also get out there, you know, everything rests on how they perform. And as I said, it's not a matter of the lack of talent. It's not a matter of the lack of will. Some of the U.S. athletes going in were ranked as favorites. For example, in the shot put, the U.S. had the potential or could have swept all 3 medals, but that didn't happen. And so, you know, at some point, the athletes also have to bear some responsibility for their performance. But I am sure there will be some changes at the top.
It's not as though it was like the 1972, I believe it was, Olympics, where the U.S. track coach failed to get his athletes to the track on time in order to make their heats. I mean, that can directly be attributed to the coach. But the chief executive officer of USA Track and Field has issued a statement saying that there's going to be a comprehensive review of all of its programs. Is that the appropriate way to go? Is that the way to handle this, you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, since the team didn't perform as well as it should have, or people thought they should have. And if you also think about it, the events in which the U.S. has traditionally dominated, this time around, they didn't really dominate it, except for the 400, where they swept all 3 top places. If you look at the sprints, the Jamaicans, Trinidad, and Walter Dix also actually did come in 3rd. But normally, you know, U.S. is well represented in the 100-meter final, especially the top maybe 5 places. But this time around, it wasn't the case. And so I'm sure they want to go back to the drawing board to figure out, well, how can we be dominant again across the board? So probably I would think that's one of the things he is taking into consideration when he makes such a statement.
We did win the women's 4x400 meter relay, which was sort of redemption for those athletes. Also, the women's discus and the decathlon. We have the quote-unquote world's greatest athlete, the label which is always applied to the person who wins the gold in the decathlon. Is that just Olympic hype, or do you think it's fair to call a decathlete who has to master or amass enough points in 10 particular athletic events to be called the world's greatest athlete?
I think so. I mean, 2 days of competition, and for the decathletes, that's 10 events, 5 events each day. Being out there for literally 12 hours, I would say, and probably more than that when you think about when they have to get up, get to the stadium, and go through all those different events. 10 events is a lot in 2 days. I'm sure Michael Phelps would not argue that point when you take into account the fact that they're doing 10 events in 2 days. So I think it's a fair title. Then there's the separate issue of, you know, when we talk about the best performances or which performances stand out. Now, that's a separate issue from describing somebody as the best all-around athlete. Yeah.
The women, of course, have the heptathlon, which is only 7 events. Do you think the female athletes of the world could have their own decathlon and take on 10 events in 2 days and not just 7?
I think it's possible. Now, why they have 7, I don't know. I guess that's the way it's always been. But sure, I mean, I'm sure even if they made it 12 events, we still have athletes completing it. But I guess at some point we have to look and think about, you know, okay, what's reasonable and which events really represent what we are trying, the concept of the best all-around athlete. So I don't think there's any point in adding additional events. If they run in the 200, the women run the 200. If you add 100 to it, it's still a sprint. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wouldn't make much sense increasing that. But yes, if it was 10, I'm sure the women would do okay.
You mentioned Jamaica's dominance in both the men's and the women's sprints. Usain Bolt won the men's 100 meter and 200 meters in world record time, and he was also on the 4x100 meter relay team that won gold in that event. He was chastised by Jacques Rogge, the head of the International Olympic Committee, for what Mr. Rogge considered to be unsportsmanlike conduct, wagging his finger and saying, "I'm number one," and pounding his chest and getting up into the face of the camera and all that sort of thing, calling himself Lightning Bolt, which the commentators were calling him for that matter. Do you think his celebration was unsportsmanlike?
I don't think it was unsportsmanlike. I think most diehard track and field fans wish, for example, in the 100 meters, that he just run through the line as opposed to celebrating early so that we could see how fast can he run.
Yeah.
But having said that, if you listen to his own comments, and let's keep in mind that he's only 21. Mm-hmm. So in terms of maturity, yeah, he still has some ways to go on that. But I don't think what he did, he intended to disrespect his opponents. And I believe in his press conference, about 20 meters to go, he was expecting his countryman, Asafa Powell, the former world record holder, to be somewhere around challenging him. And he realized, whoa, I have this thing in the pocket. And he started celebrating early. Having said that, you know, whenever you celebrate and it seems to be all about you, people feel uncomfortable because I guess it's the concept or the idea of good sportsmanship is something that people think about. So is there a better way he could have celebrated? Yes, but I don't think he meant it as a way of disrespecting his opponents, like, you know, I vanquished you all, etc. Yeah.
The Jamaicans trained on their own island. They did not come to the United States or any other country to train, as is frequently the case with foreign athletes. Does that make their accomplishment in the sprints all that much more impressive, or not necessarily?
It does. It does. Because if you take into account the fact that they have fewer resources at their disposal, facilities not as good as you may find here in the U.S. or even in some universities, such as MTSU, it makes it impressive. But one of the things which I sincerely believe, and Coach Hayes and I talk about this quite often, is the issue of the quality of the training. You know, facilities help, resources help, but they only help so much. You know, what you were doing is also important. And so it is surprising in some ways. Is that the new way to go with regards to keeping athletes at home? Some people think it is. And one of Jamaica's reasons for keeping it or trying to retain athletes in Jamaica has to do with the fact that even though a lot of them compete in the U.S. collegiate system, they compete so much because during the track season, we literally have a meet every weekend. Then you have conference championships, then you have the regionals, then you have NCAA championships. So for most athletes, they were probably a little bit burned out by the time it came around for the professional or the European circuit to get on board World Championships, Olympics. And by keeping them at home, one of the arguments in favor of that is that they are burned out because they've had fewer races. So I think it's a good approach, but I don't think it's for everybody.
How do you feel about athletes competing or training in one country, competing perhaps for another country, and being from a third country? We've seen this throughout the Olympics. Yao Ming competed for his native China, even though he plays in the National Basketball Association in the United States. Perhaps that's the most famous example. I mentioned to you that HBO profiled a young woman who did not make the Olympic team in the United States and was offered a considerable amount of money to perform for Russia and got chastised up, down, and sideways for it, but this is the way of the world, is it not?
It is, and I'll address this in from two different perspectives. As an athlete who came to the U.S. on a track scholarship and went through the NCAA system, and yet in each of the Olympics I participated in, I represented my home country, Ghana. I can relate to that. But having said that, though, you have to look, what are the purpose? Well, there are different reasons why. With the universities in the U.S., they are looking for student athletes who excel and also represent their university well. And there is no criteria or there's no restriction as to where an athlete can come from. However, when you get to the World Championships or the Olympics, there is that stipulation that the athlete has to be a citizen of a particular country. Then you take into account that the athletes whose parents may come from two different countries. And so they may actually be may have dual citizenships. Well, what do you do if you don't make it in one and you have citizenship for another one, which you could easily represent? Do you turn down the opportunity to participate in Olympics? And so it's a little bit more complicated than that. However, in track and field, one of the things that the IAAF, which is the International Association for Athletic Federations, has done is to make it more difficult for people to just switch whenever they feel like. And so now I believe you have to wait at least, I think it's 3 years. They may have bumped it up to 5 years, but you have to go through about three to five years where you haven't represented either country before you be eligible to compete. And then there's also the stipulation that at least one parent, I think, has to come from that country.
Yeah. It's you have to go through a considerable amount of paperwork. From what you saw on television, how do you think Beijing handled the games as a whole? If we're talking about the infrastructure, the facilities, the scheduling, all of the little things that go into making something look as though it's coming off perfectly.
One word: wow. if you put aside the politics, this was awesome. And even the critics, when they can put aside the politics, will say, you know, this, China's raised the bar. And in fact, London is already downplaying expectations, saying that, well, you know, when it's their turn, it will be something different. But they do recognize or understand the level to which Beijing raised the bar. And so we need to give credit where due. It's a lot of work, a lot of coordination, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of money that has gone into this, and they've been able to pull this off in a way that few countries have been able to. And so, you know, we need to give credit where due.
Do you think that the magnificence of the opening and closing ceremonies and the beauty of the bird's nest and the water cube helped people forget at least temporarily, about China's human rights record, the nastier aspects of which were still on display during the games. Mm-hmm. And do you think that that was the Chinese government's intention?
Not really. I mean, it's you know, when the games are going on, everybody's focused on you know, what the athletes are doing, or most people, I should say. Having said that, I don't think the issue of human rights and all the other issues have gone away. In fact, one can argue that it actually puts more light on China. That China wanted to be center stage, it has been center stage, and will probably still be center stage. So even some of the things they may used to have gotten away with now becomes very visible. I mean, it's and so one can make that argument. But yes, China has a long way to go. I don't think they themselves deny that. And should the pressure be kept on with regards to making sure that human rights improve in China? Definitely, yeah.
All the talk prior to Beijing was about the smog and how it was going to affect the athletes. There were even feature stories done on U.S. athletes using these particular kinds of masks. And there was a kind of mask that they would not show reporters because it was supposed to be super secret. It was treated as though it had been made by the Department of Homeland Security or something. You couldn't show it on television or anything. From what you were able to ascertain, did the smog have any effect whatsoever on the respiratory systems of the athletes? Did it have any kind of an impact like, say, the high altitude in Mexico City did in 1968, where it really did, you know, have an impact on some track athletes there?
I don't think so. And obviously, I wasn't in China, but based on what I've seen and what I've read, it looks like the issue of air pollution kind of went away once the game started. And on the contrary, environmental issues that seemed to be a problem at different times was either rain or it was just too hot. I remember watching the soccer finals between Nigeria and Argentina, and the issue had to do with heat. So for some reason, that seemed to have gone away. To what extent was the pollution overplayed? I don't think it was overplayed, but at the same time, too, China did a lot of cleaning up, including shutting down factories during the Olympics, and how those measures factored into the fact that there seemed to have been an improvement in their quality. I don't know, but definitely it looks like the pollution issue kind of went to the back once the game started.
And I didn't see any athletes competing with masks on their faces.
No, I didn't see either, not even in the marathon. So.
Although there was one lady from Bahrain, a track athlete, who had to compete with her head totally covered for religious reasons. Something that has caused a bit of a stir is doping. There are so many people who say that WADA, the international organization that is considered the gold standard for testing athletes for doping, that their standards should be employed by Major League Baseball for steroids, by the National Football League, by all sports, national and international. There weren't very many doping cases uncovered at these Olympics. I think 6 athletes total and 4 horses in the equestrian. They gave the horses capsaicin, bless their hearts. Tell us something about the testing for performance-enhancing substances. What do you have to go through? What's it like?
It's a lot, and that's a thing a lot of people don't realize. And in fact, doping, you can categorize it in many different ways, from stimulants all the way to anabolic steroids. So, for example, if I were to take a decongestant such as Sudafed during the Olympics, I would test positive for a stimulant. And you probably see on the news saying, hey, Andrew tested positive, he was trying to cheat, blah, 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 blah. For me, I don't really consider that as egregious, in the sense that now even the International Olympic Committee, WADA, etc., these kind of offenses, you get a warning because they realize what it means. People take Sudafed every day. There are a lot of people with allergy issues. But then when you talk about testing itself, it's quite rigorous. I mean, it is so much harder for an athlete to cheat now than ever before. And so when you talk about the fact that there was very few cases of positive tests, well, part of it can be attributed to how much work has gone into and the number of athletes that are being tested. And so it serves kind of as a deterrent. Now, as an athlete, So, for example, in track and field, we have what we call out-of-competition testing. So during the off-season, you may just wake up and somebody at your door knocking and you have to produce a sample. There's no running away from that. For the elite athletes, I would say those in the top 20, top 30 in the world, they have to send in a quarterly report detailing where they're going to be in the next 3 months. Which means if you say you're going to be, for let's say the next month, you're going to be in Murfreesboro, training in Murfreesboro, you better be there, because if they come looking for you and you're not around, I think the initial one counts as a warning. You missed the doping test. They will keep looking for you, and after a couple, it's considered a positive test.
And they will require you to produce a sample on site. And there is no way that you can cheat by watering down the urine or using somebody else's urine. None of that subterfuge stuff.
No. And the let me give you an example. I remember one year where I set the national record for Ghana in Zurich. Let's assume it was a Monday. On Tuesday, I was on a plane to Senegal. I got tested in Zurich. I got to Senegal to compete. This was 2 days apart. I got tested again before the competition. At the competition, I set a national, a games record. I got tested the next day. I flew to Lausanne, Switzerland for another competition. I got there very late, like 12 a.m. 6 a.m., there was a knock on my door. Somebody else, you know, there for another sample. So things like this make it hard to cheat. However, are there still people who cheat? Yeah, there are still people who cheat, people who still try to beat the system. But it is much more difficult to cheat when we talk about with regards to doping.
Well, the list of substances even has changed over the years, because I can remember in the 70s when a young American swimmer, I believe his name was Rick Dumont, had his gold medal taken away from him because he tested positive for asthma medication. Mm-hmm. And asthma is not uncommon in high-performance swimmers. And yet only a few decades later, we have Jackie Joyner-Kersee, perhaps the greatest female athlete in the world, who is an asthmatic, and she's got an endorsement deal with Primatene Mist.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought asthma up. I actually have asthma. I've had asthma since I was 8 years old. And in 95, I actually tested positive after winning a silver at the All-African Games for the active ingredient in my inhaler. Now, at that time, the only requirement was for you to state during drug testing that you are an asthmatic and this is the medication you use. Believe it or not, I had my inhaler in hand when I was undergoing the test. I forgot to just put it down. And so what ended up happening, or what I had to do, was actually produce medical records dating back all the way to when I was 8 to show or to prove that, yes, I had asthma long before I got into track and field. They've even made it much more difficult because there was a rush of people claiming to be asthmatic. So now what you actually do if you claim you're asthmatic is you have to undergo I can't remember the name, but basically where it's a test to measure the lung capacity. You blow through this. God, I wish I could remember the name of this apparatus.
Okay.
But it's a very stringent test. And then you have to send in the paperwork to the IAAF. They evaluate and then they determine whether you meet the criteria or not. So, you are right. Now it's more accepted. People realize, hey, wait a minute. There are lots of people who have asthma. It doesn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to compete. But the substance and the list of substances continually change. And they grow longer, too.
Yeah. And even though it was so long ago, the stigma of Ben Johnson still seems to hover over the Olympics, heightened perhaps by American coverage of baseball's own steroid scandal. So people think or suspect, even though these athletes have never failed drug tests to the best of our knowledge, that Usain Bolt, who set his record running into a wind, Michael Phelps and his extraordinary 8 gold medals, and Dara Torres, who won 3 silvers at the age of 41 in swimming, they cynics among us go, oh, they must have been doped up.
Well, to there's always that possibility. We can't deny that.
Yeah.
But to look at it that way is I think not giving some of these athletes the credit that they are due. Bolt, for most people, this is the first time they've heard of Usain Bolt. But Usain Bolt, when he was 16, 17 years old, broke the world junior record in, I think, the 200. So this is somebody, those of us in athletics have known that he was coming. The question was when he would emerge. 2 years ago, he went through a series of injuries, which made it difficult for him to do as well as people thought he would. But if you think about, let's go back to the Balco case, which in the U.S. was really huge because there were so many sports involved. But track and field did have a share with Marion Jones, to Montgomery, etc. Think about the sophistication. This was a lab that really designed a new steroid. Now, unless somebody is trying to tell me that here, let's look at Bolton, Asafa Powell in Jamaica, where we acknowledge they don't even have the resources some of these other athletes have. Are we saying that there's a program, or that what are the chances of finding such a sophisticated lab sitting somewhere in the corner of Jamaica doing this?
My understanding is that they don't have an international doping lab anywhere on the island. That's what I read.
But the what people don't realize is they still get tested a lot. And part of it, for example, we have Dr. Whitehill here at MTSU who does testing for WADA and sometimes for the IAAF. Very often he goes down to Jamaica to go test athletes, believe it or not. So you don't have to have a testing lab in your country. That has nothing to do with how many times you get tested or
they
how
will
often
find
you get
you.
Tested. They will find you. Yeah.
Speaking of cheating allegations, what about the female Chinese gymnast? The IOC has an inquiry underway. And looking at these young ladies on television, did you think that the majority of them were 16 years of age?
Well, the question you should ask me is, did they look 16? Well,
about two of them were teenage.
Of them that when I definitely saw them, I was like, man, that's a really, really young 16-year-old. Is there any way I can prove it? No, I can't. But there are many different ways to find out if somebody's cheating as it relates to age, because if the authorities would make records available or at least allow investigators free access, well, you can always find out their friends, who is the oldest sibling, etc. You know, so many different ways. I understand there's been some documents have come to light with regards to newspapers where one of the girls is quoted as saying she was 14. So it lends credence to the fact that there might be something going on, and not all of them may be 16-year-olds. I don't know for sure. But
Bella Caroli said that if the Chinese were cheating, shame on them and they shouldn't cheat. However, he thinks that the age limit should just be done away with. In other words, if you're 9 or 69, it shouldn't matter. If you happen to be the best athlete in the world at your sport, you should be able to compete in the Olympics. How would you feel about children that young being put through this international whirlwind of media attention and competitive pressure?
I think the IOC president, Jack Roger, said addressed this. And the best way to think about it is children at that age don't have much autonomy and can't make decisions for themselves. There's also the issue of they are still growing. And so it's an issue of protecting these children from being abused with regards to training. And the only way to ensure that is to have a minimum age. And so that's my take on it. I think there should be a limit with regards to age. And also the fact that when you think about it too, and obviously this goes for different sports. In track and field, if you're 16, you'll probably be last trying to run the 100 meters because developmentally you wouldn't be that mature, have enough muscles to be able to run that fast. But yes, I think that needs to stay in gymnastics to protect these children. Already in the U.S., we even hear cases of families that uproot themselves and give up jobs and move children at the age of 4, 5, 6 to enroll them in programs. At some point, we need to sit back and ask ourselves, you know, is this really in the interests of the children, or it's us adults / parents who are trying to live the glory through our kids?
Dr. Andrew Owusu, who is assistant professor of health and human performance here at MTSU and an Olympic veteran of 3 Olympic Games. Thanks for being with us today. This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please be with us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check us out at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.